I'm betting they will spot you a glass of wine. I could use it, or something stronger. He started off, but then stopped. Hey, can I have that gun of mine back? I stared at him for a good long while. You're kind of pushing your luck, aren't you? He glanced around. There are wolves. Wolf. Punch the safety off. I tossed him the Winchester. And don't shoot anybody. He smiled a shy grin and trooped off down the hill in my prints, not quite making the distance of my stride and slipping a few times. It was quiet for a minute or two until he began whistling to himself and whatever else might have been out there in the darkness. There was a fire, and the sheep were bedded down around the area with only one mule tied to the wagon. The vehicles were parked near it, a haphazard collection, my truck the closest. I could see my keys hanging from the ignition, along with the mic and cord of my two-way dangling from the rearview mirror. I could hear voices and see shadows reflecting off the wagon front, where Sizer Pretoria and I had sat eating the stew and drinking wine with Ariette. Dogs stood a little ways off in a slight drift, where the snow had once again taken advantage of the shade from the tree line to hang on for a few more days. He dipped his big head, sniffing the air again, detecting a million scents I would never even know existed. Taking a few more steps at an angle, I could see into the space between the International Travel Hall and the Black Wrangler to where two people were talking and laughing in a relaxed manner. Patting my leg to get dog's attention, I moved up between the vehicles and looked down at a dark spot in the snow, smaller spots trailing toward the fire. I slipped off a glove and felt the substance, lifting it to my nose. Blood. I wiped my fingers off on my jeans, slipped my glove back on, took out my .45 and punched off the safety, holding it once again at my side. Moving up to the front of the Jeep, I paused at the fender, listening as Kasich, who sat on one of the tree stumps with Liam in her lap, the two of them wrapped up in a blanket, told him a story. There was a man, a brave warrior who was known throughout the land as a great hunter. But one season, a dark winter appeared and took hold of the land, a winter unlike any before. The man and his wife and son were separated from the rest of the tribe, and in the depths of this winter they grew hungrier and hungrier. Finally, the warrior told them that he must go out into the snow and get them food, but the warrior's wife and son cried for him to not go. She propped Liam up farther on her knee and dropped her face so that the child could see her. The warrior, realizing that they would die if he did not find them food, went out into the storm, warning them to not open the flap of the teepee unless they heard his voice, which they promised to do. He searched the frozen land for any signs of game, but could not find any to kill. Finally, becoming exhausted, he returned to the lodge where he heard his son crying in hunger and his wife assuring him that his father was a great hunter and would not return without food for his family. I leaned against the fender of the International, and my movement must have caught her attention. She stared at me for a moment with those light-colored eyes and then continued. The warrior turned back into the storm, but after a while he became weak and fell in the snow. Then he heard a voice calling out from the trees, "Brother, why do you despair? My family is starving, and I can find no food for them. Brother, do you feel the warmth of my breath on your throat?" She breathed on the neck of the boy, and he squirmed, and they both laughed. "Yes," he said, as the darkness closed in and he felt himself become unconscious. "Know that with the power of my jaws I could kill you, but instead I will help you because you have a great responsibility to your family, but you must thank me." When the man awoke again, there was a great hunk of flesh on his chest, the hock of a buffalo, more than enough to feed his family. Resting himself from the snow, he stood and called out to the trees, "How can I thank you when I do not even know who or what you are?" The voice carried back from the trees on the wind, "You will know me." The warrior went back to the lodge and called out, and his wife opened the flap. They cooked the meat, and it was very good, but more than they could eat. Sitting there around the fire, they began drifting off to sleep, when a voice in the warrior's own called from outside, asking to be let in. The warrior's wife said no, that there could be nothing surviving out in the storm that would bring them any good. But the warrior untied the straps, and suddenly the largest wolf any of them had ever seen forced its head inside the teepee, first looking at the child, then the woman, and finally at the warrior. Realizing that he could not reach his weapons, the warrior decided to distract the wolf by throwing it some of the leftover meat, which the wolf devoured in a second, not giving the warrior time to get his bow and arrow. They sat there looking at each other, and then the wolf spoke in the voice he had learned from the man. "I told you you would know me." Dog, sensing the story was about him or his kin, stepped in a little closer to the fire as Liam's eyes grew wide. The wolf lived with them and lingered fearlessly in their camp, and that is how we came to have dogs. Dog wagged and circled the fire, standing a little away from them. "Howdy." They both looked up at me, Kasich enclosing Liam in her arms with the blanket.
"That was fast."
"It didn't seem like it." I glanced around. "Where are the others?"
She cocked her head at me.
"Where's Jacques?"
"On his way down to paradise and a glass of wine."
"He's better suited to that."
She glanced at Liam.
"Are you tired, honey?"
He nodded, and she hugged him and walked him toward the sheep wagon, carefully lifting him through the open door at the rear where her dog stood waiting.
"You cover up with Gansu, and I'll be there in a minute."
He looked past her at me and then lifted something to his mouth and blew, the comical noise coming from the toy badge Sizer Batory had given him. I saluted, and he saluted me back, smiling as she closed the door and returned to the fire, putting the blanket around herself and crossing her arms.
"You don't seem surprised by all this?"
Holstering the .45, I shrugged a shoulder. "Oh, I'm sure there will be parts, and I will be, but not by you."
"Starting with?"
"Your name. Henry said it's Cree for sky blue. Eyes just like Jake's at Chapare. And then when you slipped up and mentioned that your grandfather had been run over by a train..."
"You know that story?"
"Abarane mentioned that he married a native woman that night at the ranch, and that he'd been run over by a train."
"But that couldn't have been all."
"Abe was the last person you called on your cell phone." She stared at me.
"I thought you didn't know how to operate those things."
"I'm learning." They came around the jeep and leaned against the grill guard. "You were the woman Miguel met at the house near the airport."
"So?"
"Whatever it was it worth killing him for?"
"I didn't kill him."
"Then who did?"
"Not me."
Unconsciously, she glanced past me to the southwest and the trees where the shepherd had been hung.
"How did you know?"
"You were the only person who knew that Liam had been placed with the Anders. You called Abarane, and that's how he knew where to find him. You also slipped up and said Henry had broken your father's arm instead of the uncle that you mentioned earlier." I pointedly looked over my shoulder, slowly turning my head back to her. "Other than the family connection, what is it that has you and Abarane working together?"
"A mutual enemy."
She hugged herself tighter.
"What was your childhood like?"
"I don't have time for this." She raised her voice.
"What was your childhood like?"
I stood there looking at her. "Uneventful."
"What the hell does that mean?"
"I didn't have an alcoholic father or a negligent mother. It was just normal."
"Lucky you."
She looked back at the fire.
"By the way, I didn't say my mother was negligent.
You hardly mentioned her at all. Victims are rarely leading roles in their or anybody else's lives." She reached in her jacket under the blanket and pulled out some sheets of paper, unfolding them.
"I hope you don't mind, but I took the files on Miguel from the Immigration and Customs that were lying on the dispatcher's desk. Have you looked at them?"
I pushed off the jeep and Dog turned to glance at me.
"No, I haven't had time."
"Good."
She tossed them in the fire and watched them burn. We both stood there like that for a moment.
which I suppose was what she was trying to accomplish, but my conversational skills were running a little dry anyway. By my count, there would be three of them out there. She ignored me, her eyes staying with the fire.
Are they armed?
She continued to ignore me. I asked you, are they armed? The chin came up, and the eyes flared in the firelight.
Yes.
Are you?
No.
Good. I started to turn with dog in tow, but then diverted to my truck, where I pulled open the door and grabbed my keys from the ignition and my old blanket-sided canteen.
Dog looked at me. I know, but there are people out here with guns, and they may not be able to tell the difference between you and a wolf.
He didn't move. I unscrewed the top and took a swig of the cold water. Come on, kennel up. He still didn't move. Truck! He sat. Ham! He jumped into the truck and turned around to face me as I closed the door. He sat, realizing he'd been had.
Coming around the front, I slipped the canteen under my shoulder, pulled the big Colt from my holster, and glanced at Kasich.
Don't go anywhere.
She nodded toward the wagon and then reached down, throwing another log into the fire. I wouldn't leave Liam and Gansu or your dog, for that matter. Starting off, I could see where a number of prints of different species had tracked through the snow in the direction of the hanging tree. It looked to be about a quarter mile to the tree line at the other side of the park, and the air was so motionless it was as if the mountain were holding its breath. Her voice was soft, but in the dead silence it carried.
You could let it go, you know. Just turn around, get in your truck, and get the hell out of here.
I paused to look back at her, fully lit by the light from the campfire.
We both know I can't do that.
It would be better, trust me.
I laughed a bitter bark of air and stared at the lone Jenny tied to the wagon before starting off again.
One more thing?
Yeah?
I growled my response.
You're missing a mule.
Chapter 16. The drifts were high in spots, and I stumbled along in the frozen air, ice clinging to the stubble on my face as the temperature plummeted. I reached up to try to rub a little feeling into my chin and watched as the frost shards fell from the stubble on my face. Oddly, the scar that streaked the skin around my left eye felt warm, as if the hide was too tough to feel cold. It's a common fallacy that cloudy nights are the coldest. It's the clear, glittering nights where a bone-shattering cold comes from the unending universe and descends upon the earth, shagging the trees with ice in a landscape that goes on interminably. The lodgepole pines and Engelmann spruces jostled as if jockeying for position at the timberline, and waved their branches in anticipation of a race they would never run, or maybe beckoning, calling me forward to whatever fate they held. There was a gust every once in a while, just enough to let you know what wind chill could do if it wished, coat you, bury you, or freeze you stiff where you stood. Taking the canteen from my shoulder, I took another sip of the cold water. I saw the shot before I heard it, and turned to look at it slap into the snow a yard or two to my right. I stopped and was fully aware that the only thing I could do would be to flatten out in the snow.
Just in case you don't know who I am, it's Walt Longmire, Absaroka County Sheriff.
There was no response.
You've just shot at a police officer, which is a serious offense, so I would advise you to hold your fire.
Nothing.
I'm coming ahead.
Still nothing. Starting off again, I saw the slap in the snow a couple of yards ahead of me, seeing the evidence of the shot when the sound arrived. The next time, I saw the muzzle flash and raised my Colt, placing around in the vicinity of the shooter before running to the left to make the shorter distance to the tree line before they recovered and took aim again. There was another shot, but this one was a good 20 yards to my right, which led me to believe that whoever was firing was either inexperienced or snap-shooting with abandon. Either way, it was someone who wasn't used to being shot at, and that gave me more of an advantage. Just to keep him off balance, I threw another round at the area, which was enough to get me to the first tree trunk, which was about half my width. Semi-cover not being what I was looking for, I kept charging until I got to a larger copse that was adjacent to the forest and then moved between the trees. I allowed my eyes to settle in the gloom and walked softly in the direction of the shooter, the deep powder quieting my steps. Figuring he'd think I was going to try to flank him, I stayed near the front of the tree line, only dodging back when I needed the cover. I stopped and smelled the air drifting from the shooter's direction. Cigarette smoke. Leaning a little to the side, I could have sworn I'd seen a smoldering ember. Then I saw it again, but now near the ground, as if it might have been discarded, but then it moved and grew brighter as if someone were inhaling a puff before lowering it to arm's length. Careful to be soundless, I edged my way to the left and started to circle. Whoever it was didn't move, just continued smoking. I'd gotten behind him and could see that the shooter was sitting at the base of one of the trees with a rifle in his lap and a cigarette in his right hand. Jimenez sat there, blood leaching down one side of his face.
"Don't shoot! Don't shoot again, Dios mío!"
I holstered my Colt and knelt down beside him, tugged the scoped .243 from his lap, and stood it beside me, the bolt action open. I pulled back his do-rag to reveal a 3-inch tear in his scalp where the round had skimmed alongside his skull. Lucky shot. He continued smoking.
"No for me, damn it."
Putting a bandana from my coat pocket, I discarded the rag and then folded the flap of flesh back and tied the bandana around his scalp. Bleeding worse than it is, but it's a head wound, so that makes sense.
"My most hard part."
"Can you stand?"
See.
He started to get up, but collapsed against the tree trunk.
"Maybe not so much just yet."
I glanced around. "Where are the others?"
"Where do you think?"
I turned and looked deeper into the high forest. "I need to go, and I might not find you on the return trip, so I need you to get up and follow my tracks back to the sheep wagon, where Kasich can take care of you." He continued to smoke.
"If there is a return trip..."
I extended my hand again. "You better hope there is." He looked at it for a moment and then stuffed the cigarette in the corner of his mouth, both hands grabbing mine as he slowly rose, using my hand and the tree for support.
"My head, it hurts."
"Uh-huh, I bet." Walking him to the edge of the tree line, I pointed toward my prints that cut across the park at a diagonal before straightening at the point where he'd first shot at me. "You see my tracks?"
See.
"Follow them. If you get in trouble and have to sit down and can't get back up, sing, and I'll find you." He looked up at me.
"Sing what?"
"Twinkle, twinkle, little star, for all I care. Just make some noise so I can find you." He nodded, and then immediately regretted it as he started to slip sideways. I caught his shoulder.
"Can I have my gun?"
He swallowed and stretched his eyelids. "Nope."
"Okay."
"Do you have more ammo for this M77?
See.
He pulled a small box from his coat breast pocket and rattled it before handing it to me.
"There's 2 more rounds in there."
Reloading the bolt action, I looped the sling over my shoulder. "Pretty sure of your shooting." He stood there wavering a bit.
"I didn't want to shoot you, Sheriff. The sooner I get off this mountain and get rid of this whole business, the happier I will be."
I pointed that way. Without another word, he started off and had taken only 5 or 6 steps when he started to sing.
"Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are, up above the world so high, like a diamond in the sky."
Satisfied he was headed the right way, I turned, ran a thumb under the leather sling, and started off in the direction I knew by heart. I looked through the loopholed scope and watched him standing by the fire. He cradled what looked to be the same Remington Model 11 shotgun in his arms. Behind him, in the shadows, was a man on a mule. I held the bolt action at hip level and circled to the left so as to not come in straight at him. My first thought was to shout out and let the .243 do my work for me, but I wasn't sure what the animal might do. Moving through the trees, I came at him obliquely.
"Hello, Abe."
He didn't even bother looking up.
"Hello there, Walter."
"Nice night for a fire." He was wearing a pair of insulated coveralls, a heavy hunting jacket, and slip-on snow boots, probably the emergency clothes he kept in the travel hall.
Yeah, this is.
"Same shotgun?"
He adjusted the thing slightly in his hands.
Yeah, yeah. You get used to these old things, and you just can't let go, you know?
Now that I was in close, I thumbed the toggle safety, looped the strap of the Ruger under my shoulder, and slipped out my coat in one easy movement.
I do.
You didn't hurt them none, did you?
I gestured with the Colt to make sure he saw it. Talked Jacques out of it. But I had to deflect a 45 round off Jimenez's hard head.
That him I had singing so terrible?
Yep.
Liam and my other relative, that's Gasek?
They're fine. I glanced over at a bloody-faced Donnie Lott, sitting on the mule, with his hands tied behind his back, rope around his neck, his eyes wide, and his mouth duct-taped shut.
What are we doing here, Abe?
For the first time his eyes rose to mine, and I could see how weak and depleted he looked.
Justice. We be doing justice.
That isn't what this looks like to me. He took a deep breath and went back to studying the fire, his complexion gray and sallow.
Well, you don't know the whole story now, do you?
I'm waiting to hear it. For the first time, he turned toward me, but the shotgun remained leaning on his shoulder.
You done your duty. Now go on home.
I stood there, unmoving.
I don't want to shoot you, Walter.
And I don't want to have to shoot you, Abe. I took a step closer. You're in no condition to be up here in the thin air, and I think you better slow down and think about what you're doing. There was a long moment that passed like an ice age, and then, in the near distance, I could hear a low, mournful call that wavered through the thin air like a spirit itself. Abarani's head rose, and he smiled.
I hear you, you old bastard.
We both listened, but there was nothing more.
He lonely, that old guy, but he ain't gonna find nobody like himself.
His eyes came back to mine.
He owe me a sheep, but I respect him.
I glanced at the man on the mule and then back at the old Basque. Abe, let's try and stay with the subject.
I am.
He shuffled a bit, but then stood still.
You don't see those animals taking advantage of their young, do you?
That's what this is all about? His dark eyes glinted in the campfire.
He killed that man.
Miguel Hernandez?
Yap.
Why?
Because Miguel know what he done.
Another deep breath and a tremor passed through him.
He confront that bastard there, and that son of bitch kill him.
So, Donnie was the one who attacked Miguel at the Euskadi bar?
Yap, and now I'ma kill him.
It's your son-in-law, Abe.
That man no blood of mine.
He stared into the fire.
That boy, he try and tell his mama, he try and tell me, but nobody believe him. So he just stopped talking.
He shook his head and began sobbing.
Somebody do that to a child, their own child.
He glanced at Donnie, then looked back at me, tears lining his face.
I got to spell that out for you. He abused my daughter and his own son.
He glared back at Donnie.
Hanging too good for a man that do that.
Abe, if he's done what you say, then we'll take him in, and he'll be charged, tried in a court, and sentenced according to the law. He shook his head, coughing.
Nope, nope, nope.
Abe, do you want Liam to live his life, knowing that his grandfather killed his father? I took another step. You're all he's got, Abe. Don't rob that boy of the only chance he has. His jaw drew tight, and the word was barely audible as his hand slipped down to the trigger on the shotgun.
No.
Don't do it.
The shine of the tears on his drawn face reflected as he stared at the popping and hissing fire, his breath fogging the distance of about 12 feet between us before being burned away into nothingness.
I think about my father. Now that was a man. He was rough, but he'll love us more than anything in the world. I remember being ashamed of him when I find out he go to prison that time for not even shooting Lucien.
His face turned to me.
Imagine that, being ashamed of your own father.
I became aware of some movement to Abarani's right and could have sworn there was something out there in the darkness just as I had on the climb up.
The mule was getting fidgety, his nostrils distended as he smelled whatever was out there and sashayed back a bit, forcing Donnie's head forward by the rope, the blood dripping from his face.
Ashamed of family! Imagine that!
Straining my eyes past the heat wavering from the fire, I could see whatever it was had moved, and from the glint of the golden eyes out past the campfire, I knew exactly who and what it was. The eyes didn't move, but just hung there. They blinked. 777M. He lifted his head and sniffed, probably picking up the blood on Donnie's face. He'd found something to eat in this exact spot before, and probably thought he'd try the buffet again. Abarane. Paying me no attention, Abe stepped from the fire toward the man on the mule and raised the foreshortened barrel of the shotgun.
Sometimes I feel like that some people's, some families is just cursed.
The wolf shifted to the left, and I could still see the glittering eyes and now the intimidating bulk of the thing.
Abe.
He raised the shotgun straight up in the one hand.
You do what you got to do there, Walt, but that man, he gotta die.
Abe. The wolf shot from behind him, perhaps confusing the blood dripping from Donnie's face with the mule. Abe, surprised out of his wits, half-turned, stepped back, and fell over a loose log, the shotgun going off as he hit the ground beside the fire. The mule, already crow-hopping to one side to avoid the wolf, bucked with an incredible screech before it bolted out from under Donnie. Galloping between Abe and me, he barely missed the fire, but carried embers as he disappeared into the darkness with the wolf on his iron-shod heels. Abe sat there, watching the helpless man kicking the air and swinging back and forth. Running toward Donnie, I holstered my .45, the .243 in my canteen falling to the ground. I grabbed his feet and placed them on my shoulders and yelled up at him, "Don't panic! Stand on my shoulders!" He tried to continue kicking, but I held fast. "Put your weight on my shoulders, and it'll keep you from strangling." I felt him steady a bit, but then he leaned forward. "And try and stay balanced!" Looking in that direction, I could see Abarane had stood and was backing up and stumbling away. "Abe, help!" He stopped and looked at me for an instant and then turned and ran, swallowed by the black of the forest. "Abe!" There was no response. Trying to help Donnie get his balance, I called out to him calmly, "Donnie, if you can hear me, just make a noise." He whimpered. "Good, now look, we're going to have to get your hands free, and the only thing that'll do that is this knife I've got in my pocket, and I'm going to have to let go of one of your feet to get it out and hand it up to you, all right?" He whimpered again. "Now, once I get it out of my pocket, I'm going to reach up behind you, and you're going to take it and cut that rope around your hands. Then you can cut that rope around your neck, got it?" He moaned. Taking one of my hands away, I slipped my fingers into my pocket and pulled the sag-handled case out. Carefully, I handed it up behind him, trying my best not to dislodge his boot from my shoulder. I could feel him fumbling with his fingertips. "I'll try to get it higher." Pushing his boot closer to my head, I could feel him getting a better grip on the thing. "Do you have it? I'm not letting go until you're sure." He whimpered again, but this time it was louder. "Okay, I'm letting go. But whatever you do, don't drop it, because I don't have another one." I could feel him adjusting his hands and assumed he'd begun sawing at the hemp behind his back. Looking straight ahead, I tried to remember the last time I'd sharpened the damn thing and made a mental note to be a better knife owner in the future. Donnie stopped moving. "Hey, just keep working on that rope. Whatever happens, just keep cutting, you got me?" He whimpered again and continued. I felt something strike my back and heard something fall to the snow behind me. "Please tell me you didn't just drop the knife." Silence. I almost laughed. "All right, I'm going to have to stoop down and get it." He made no noise at all. "We have to have that knife, and unless you've got a better idea, I'm going to have to let you hang for a few seconds while I get it." There was still no response. "I'll ease down and then grab the knife and come back up, so have your feet ready to rest on my shoulders. It'll only be a second, so hang on." It was a poor choice of words, but I felt his legs tense and figured he was ready. "Donnie, are you ready? Here we go." I eased into a crouch and felt in the snow for the knife, but couldn't find it. Desperately thrusting my hands into the snow, I came up only with a set of car keys on a Jeep fob. Hearing Donnie strangling above me, I stood quickly and placed his boots under my shoulders again. "I couldn't find it, but I found your keys, of all things." There was no sound. "Donnie, I need to try again." Looking up, I could see his face staring down at me, the pressure of the rope having turned it dark and distended. One eye was battered, partially shut, and the other bugged out at me as he shook his head. "I need to get that knife." He shook his head again. "What?" Looking down at me, I could see him struggling with the tape, trying to talk. After a few seconds, he gave up and closed his eyelids, only to open them a second later with a passive resolve. The next thing I knew, he'd kicked my shoulders away and was swinging his legs in all directions, clocking me in the ear with a hiking boot. I tried to grab his legs again, but he continued to struggle and refused to let me take the weight. After another outburst, I got a hold of his legs, but they were limp and lifeless. Whirling about, I looked for where the rope might have been tied off, but could see nothing. Taking my flashlight from my belt, I followed the hemp rope tied around the man's neck to a branch above where it looped over and continued. Running behind him, I finally found where the thing was secured to a lower limb on another tree, but with the tension on the rope and the tightness of the knot, it seemed like it took forever to untie the thing. I watched as Donnie fell to the ground in a heap. Lunging back toward him, I pried my fingers under the noose and freed it, but he remained motionless. I pulled off my hat and placed an ear to his chest. Nothing. Ripping away the tape and rolling his head to one side, I began attempts to resuscitate him, but he didn't respond. Finally, I sat back on my haunches and stared at the dead man. After a moment, I saw his hands still tied together. The one desperately clutched around something. Leaning forward, I pried his curled fingers apart to find my knife still there. I found the mule at the edge of the park about 100 yards away. He was a little reluctant to return to the scene of the hanging, but even less enthused about staying out there in the darkness with 777M. Catching the leather lead, I walked him back and tied him to what looked to be a sturdy tree. I wrapped the body in the saddle blanket and loaded the dead man onto the mule's back. Kicking the remaining embers of the fire into a pile, I shuffled snow on top of it, effectively putting it out, and then coiled up the rope and hung it over my shoulder with the 243 and my canteen. I made the clearing and could see the prints Jimenez had made inside mine, the only marks on the pristine snow. The mule got used to the idea of walking and took less pulling, finally matching stride with me as I tromped on. Somewhere below zero, I occupied myself with the sins of the fathers that are visited on the children, and how strong a person it took to break those chains and stop a personal evil that is visited on the truly innocent. When I crested the hill, I could see the fire from the sheep camp, as could the mule, which brayed to his friend, the Jenny, tied up there, who answered his call with an ear-splitting response, so much for a stealthy approach. Jimenez and the jeep were gone, but two people still faced the fire. Kasich Chichu sat huddled with a blanket wrapped tightly around her. Even from the distance, I could see her blue eyes focused on the dancing flames as she lifted a bota and swallowed some wine. Abarane sat beside her, still holding the shotgun. Neither of them moved. I stepped back and carefully lifted the body under the hood of the International in plain view. Hanging the Ruger on the grill guard of the old truck, I turned and unscrewed the top of the canteen, taking a swig. "Well, there's your handiwork. I hope you're proud." His voice resonated in his chest as if inside a tomb. "You think this was something I enjoy? I would have hoped there was something that was so distasteful that you wouldn't have done it. What if it was your grandchild? What if it was your daughter?" I turned to her. "You stay out of this. You've done nothing but enable this entire mess, including the death of Miguel Hernandez."
"I did no such thing. He found out about it and confronted Donnie on his own. I begged him not to do it, but he was so adamant about the whole thing and that it had to be stopped.
Did it ever occur to either of you to come to me with this?" They sat there, silent.
"Well?"
Kasich glanced at Abe and then turned back to me.
"The man was psychotic. He'd already killed Miguel. Do you think he would have stopped at killing Jeannie or Liam or any of us?"
"You could have come to me."
"And then what?" Abarani tried to save his daughter, but she was paralyzed with fear, not only for herself, but for what Donnie had and would continue to do to their child, so Abe took him. What would you have done?"
Pulling the Colt from my holster, I reached around and took the handcuffs from my belt. "Stand up." He didn't move.
I said, stand up. Finally finding his voice, he shook his head.
No, I don't think I will.
I loomed over the fire, feeling the heat. Don't make me use force, Abe. He rubbed his nose and smiled a sad grin.
I heard about that force of yours from Jacques, and I don't think I want helping.
Put the shotgun down, Abe.
No, I don't think I do that either.
He stood unsteadily and directed the shotgun away from me, knowing I would fire in an instant otherwise.
I think about that old man of mine, the one that's supposed to shoot Lucien.
He shook his head.
Crazy times that was. I think them times is long forgotten, but now I see that crazy times is all around us, waiting for the opportunity to step up and shake hands all over again.
There was a wavering sound that carried in the high wind, with a sorrow and loneliness that was profound. We all paused to listen, and Abarene barked a laugh.
Es des Agunen, Roaldia, otso Roaldia da.
I listened for the wolf again, but there was only silence. What does that mean, Abe? For the first time his eyes met mine, and there was none of the sing-song rhythm in his voice. A land of strangers is a land of wolves. I could see his hands tightening on the Remington. Don't do it, Abe. He stared at me, dark eyes glinting in the reflection of the fire, and I knew he'd made up his mind.
It's like that, you know. You kill a man, and you kill yourself.
I raised the .45, leveling it at his chest.
God is good, but he's not crazy.
Suddenly there was a whirring sound. We all froze. There stood Liam on the steps of the wagon with a blanket wrapped around his shoulders, his bare legs exposed, and Kasich's dog Gansu beside him. Abarene stood unmoving, licking his lips, trying to find his voice.
Did Papi wake you up with that loud talk?
The boy nodded.
Well, you go on back in there, and stay warm.
No, Liam, don't. The old man turned to look at me as I put away the cuffs and holstered the Colt.
Why don't you come out here and join us?
Walking around the campfire, I moved past Kasich and, wrapping him more securely in the blanket, lifted the boy into my arms and turned back toward the fire. Gansu joined her mistress as I approached Abarene with his grandchild tucked into my arms. The child smelled good, of warmth, sleep, and life, wiping away the smell of gunmetal and death with his small, fragile breaths. Put the gun down and take your grandson, Abarene. The lines in his face smoothed and softened as tremors of emotion overtook him. Take your grandson, Abe. A sob broke from his twisted mouth. The old man tossed the shotgun aside and reached out to take the boy, burying him against his chest with a retching cry that rivaled that of the wolf. Epilogue. We sat on the tailgate of my truck and stared at another dead sheep. I'm thinking Larry is pushing his luck. I didn't respond. She gave me the same look she'd been giving me all afternoon, trying to read my unsettled mood. I watched as Butler and Kaplan worked the freshly killed carcass. This one's only 24 hours old, so they'll be able to get a more definitive read on what killed it, right?
Yep.
She turned back to the grisly scene.
So, spoke with Larry lately?
I didn't say anything.
You think he's still out here?
I studied the tree line leading to the high country. In one form or another. She sipped the coffee from the chrome lid of my old Stanley thermos and looked out at the fresh blanketing from 2 days ago.
Snow in May. Welcome to the Bighorn Mountains.
The absence of all color.
What?
White. The absence of all color. It's like nature has wiped the board clean and left nothing. I sat there, looking at the snow, feeling like I was falling into it, and smiled a sad smile. Rapidly becoming my favorite thing. She stared at me.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Nothing. I'm talking about nothing. Absolutely nothing. I took a deep breath and slowly exhaled, watching a thick haze lift into the air and dematerialize. What day of the week is it?
It's Friday.
I stretched my side, trying to unkink the muscles in my ribcage without pulling my stitches. Seems like a weekend.
Uh-huh.
She handed me back the cup.
You sure you're all right?
I refilled the cap and took a slug.
What time is it?
You having some kind of cognitive disassociation or something?
No.
I lowered the cup. I'm just wondering what time it is. She glanced at her watch with all its buttons and dials.
It's 4:20.
The office will be closed by the time we get back down.
Yeah, and it's still going to be Friday.
Raising her voice, she called out at the two men.
Hey, when are you two possum patrolmen going to finish up here?
Butler, the brand inspector, turned to look at her.
I'm sorry, are we interrupting your coffee break?
As a matter of fact, you are. Besides, there's a nice fire back at my house and a half bottle of Chianti that's calling my name. So let's get this wrapped up, shall we?
Ferris Kaplan rose, distributing portions of the victim into Ziploc bags and removing his plastic gloves.
Can I come?
Vic smirked at him.
I said a half bottle, carp cop.
Not taking the remark seriously, the bearded game warden stepped around Butler and crossed toward us.
Can't blame a guy for trying.
He turned back as Butler stood and joined him.
Well?
The older man tipped his signature black hat back and rubbed a calloused hand over his face before blinking and making the pronouncement.
Cat.
Kaplan nodded in professional confirmation.
Cat. Hallelujah!
My undersheriff raised her face to the retreating sun and then turned back to them.
Wait, once they get the taste for human flesh, is it hard to break them of the habit too?
Ignoring her, I asked, you sure? They both looked at me, Butler frowning.
What, you wanted it to be your wolf?
No, not really, but I guess I wanted to know if he's still here. Butler shook his head as he glanced at me knowingly.
If he's not dead, he's moved on to greener pastures. Too much activity around these parts, I'd say.
Where would he go?
He shrugged. Back in the park. The basin or farther north into Montana would be my guess.
He looked at Kaplan, who nodded in agreement.
Anyway, you don't get another public wolf scare with this one.
Vic looked up at me.
No such thing as a mountain lion scare?
It was Kaplan's turn to shake his head.
Sometimes, but not much, which is kind of surprising in that they're much more capable killers, especially solitary ones. It's odd, too, because unlike wolves, they'll sometimes kill a dozen sheep in one attack, just because they're moving. I mean, they're cats.
Too much like us.
They all turned to look at me.
Wolves.
They're too much like us, which is why they scare people.
Too much like us in their use of hierarchy, teamwork, cooperation, territory, ritual, and loyalty.
I kept my thermos and moved toward the driver's side of my truck, opened the door and greeted my own great beast in his part-time lair. Ruffling his ears in an attempt to get him over the grudge he'd been holding against me for about a month now, I jammed the thermos into the seat cushion in the back and turned to look at them. Except sometimes humans aren't very loyal at all.
So he forgot and tied up the mule?
Yep.
I navigated the switchbacks slowly, enjoying the ride down the mountain. Donnie wasn't much of a cowboy, and given his state of mind, I guess he forgot. She reached back, letting Dog lick her open palm.
But he was the guy who beat up Miguel at the bar?
Yep.
I got an inkling of that when Jeannie said she and her husband had taken line dancing lessons and that he'd bought an outfit and had.
All this because Miguel found out about the abuse?
It would appear.
So, Mickey Southern, pervert hunter, was right?
In a way.
What way?
Donnie Lott was Mickey Southern.
You've got to be kidding.
Sancho went back to the Denver PD, and because of the seriousness of the crime, they were able to get an injunction that forced the server folks to give up the info on the Southern site. I guess he'd been doing this for years as some kind of recompense for his actions.
There are no formal charges,
but Jeannie admitted that there had been instances in the past that had been covered up.
She protected the son of a bitch?
It's not unusual. From the abuser of your own child, never mind yourself? Funny where those lines of loyalty delineate themselves, huh? She gave it some thought.
So, Miguel finds out Donnie is beating his wife and molesting his own kid and threatens to tell Abarane, so Donnie gets the shepherd drunk and hangs him.
There were also the arboglyphs that the shepherds were using to communicate between themselves, including the one with the man and boy, the one with the evil eye warning.
What about the whole Colombian connection?
A diversion. We hit the straits past the runaway truck cable system, and I gave the three-quarter ton a bit more steam. By that time, Donnie was on his last rope, so to speak. He'd accidentally run into me at the gas station and got spooked. He must have felt like the world was closing in on him, which it was.
So, being an IT guy, he figured a way to crack into the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment files and insert the incorrect fingerprints?
He did. But the photos didn't match.
How about the ICE guy? Did he show?
Yep.
And?
He got a nice tour of the museums in Absaroka and Sheridan counties before having a beer at the Mint Bar and getting back on a plane to D.C.
At least he knows where Wyoming is now. She shook her head. What about the choo-choo woman?
Kasich, Cree for sky blue, like her eyes, and like the eyes of her grandfather, Jake's. She'd been in touch with Abarane after following up on Miguel. I think she knew about what was going on and used Hernandez as a point of contact. Then she and Abe worked together to get Donnie.
Teamwork.
Once the investigation started, they saw me as a real threat, and her main job was to keep an eye out and make sure I didn't get too close.
Territory.
Blood being thicker than water.
Loyalty.
She shook her head.
So all the wolves go to jail?
Inchoate crimes.
Excuse me?
A legal term, relatively specific to the state of Wyoming. Inchoate crimes are attempted crimes committed by accessories or by conspirators. Both Abarane and Kasich were charged with attempted involuntary manslaughter and arranged a plea hearing and sentencing whereby they can plead nolo contendere. They were promised that they would be placed on probation, including but not limited to whether or not they go to jail.
Burns Selby is okay with that?
The judge likes to see justice done.
You talked to him.
I did.
You also talked to the prosecutor and explained that Donnie was an internet predator, a spousal abuser, a pedophile and a child molester, of his own child, no less, and the murderer of Miguel Hernandez.
I did, and also pointed out Donnie's decision to not extricate himself from the noose, which would warrant a more lenient treatment of both Abarane and Kasich.
You think he dropped his spare set of keys in an attempt to get you to let go of him?
When I didn't respond, she shook her head.
Why not? I mean, you beat your wife, molest your own son, and there isn't going to be much solace from anybody.
No, there's not.
So, time served, and Honest Abe is back at his ranch, cutting hay to feed to the sheep the wolves are going to eat.
Rolling into town, I slowed and made the turn, pulling in and parking beside the jail.
More or less. And Kasich teach you?
I don't know, and tell the truth, I don't care.
Inchoate crimes. It does have a ring to it.
Once again, she stared at me.
Come over and help me drink wine?
I thought there's only a half bottle.
I lied.
She unbuckled her seatbelt and knelt on her seat, placing her elbows onto the center console and breathing on the side of my face.
Come on, I'll make spaghetti and we'll have sex.
I shook my head. I don't think I can do this anymore.
Sex or spaghetti?
I smiled. Maybe I've finally had enough of what people can do to each other.
I got there a long time ago.
I turned to look at her, those eyes very close. So why go on?
Because we're doing good, Walt.
We're the only thing that holds the wolves at bay. That's unfair to wolves.
Yes, it is. Here's where the hierarchy comes into play. We're the alphas, the ones that fight for decency and the common good.
Think we're winning?
That's not important. The important part is the fighting. I can't believe I'm giving this pep talk to you. I don't know much, but I know you've got to stand for something in this life. You have to fight for something. Some people go their whole lives without standing up or against something that's wrong. I don't know about you. Actually, I do. We don't want to be those people, so that means we play by the rules, fight the fights, and take the shots.
It was silent there in the truck. The only noise was dogs breathing. I think I'll just go in and get a few things done and then head home. Sit in my chair and look out the window.
Well, maybe that's the fight for today.
She knelt there with her eyes on me for quite some time and then turned, sat, and opened her door. She stood out and stood with a hand resting on the handle.
Whatever you decide to do, I better be part of the equation.
I nodded.
Yep.
She quietly closed the door, and I watched as she climbed into her unit, fired it up, and swung it around beside me. She cranked down her window. I stared at her with a questioning look.
Just so you know, I lost the office pool.
Rolling up her window, she jetted out of the parking lot at just under light speed, pausing only a moment to give me the finger. I don't know how long I sat there, but it was dark, and the next thing I was aware of was Dog sniffing my ear and placing his head on my shoulder.
You need to get out, buddy?
I could feel his weight shifting the truck as he moved to the suicide door behind me. I unbuckled my seatbelt, opened my door, and stepped out to open his. I watched him as he leapt to the ground and trotted to the edge of the parking lot between us and the courthouse to relieve himself with a one-leg salute. Standing there waiting, I studied the traffic lights and then turned and gazed at the red stone front of the old library with its two columns and tall windows, one of 1,679 such buildings philanthropist Andrew Carnegie donated to communities across the nation from 1886 to 1919. I felt as old as the building. I glanced up at the dark clouds and scattered moonlight that was highlighting the Bighorn Mountains. Patting my leg, I made for the door and was surprised to find it ajar. I held it for Dog, who bounded ahead as I slowly followed him up the stairs. Sessa Pretoria was sitting on Ruby's stool, leafing through a copy of Wyoming Wildlife magazine, tossing it onto the counter as I approached.
Welcome home.
Thanks. What are you doing here so late?
Waiting for the results. Neither wolf nor dog?
Cat.
A mountain lion. Do you have to worry about that, too?
Probably not.
Good. I don't think I've got the stamina for another scare.
He stood, stretched, and yawned.
Ruby left a note for you in your office.
I stared at him. A note?
Yeah, boss.
With a deep sense of dread, I approached my office and looked inside at the large envelope lying on my otherwise naked desktop.
Where's the computer?
She had me put it downstairs on the communal desk. He joined me at the door and peered over my shoulder.
I have no idea what it says.
Entering my office, I sat in my chair and studied the intimidating cursive handwriting, spelling out my full name.
I thought I was doing pretty well.
The computer?
He crossed his arms and leaned on the door jamb. What, you want it back?
No. He pulled something from his uniform shirt pocket.
I almost forgot. I was cleaning out the prisoner personal possessions locker and found the rucksack Kasich Tichu left behind, and these fell out.
He tossed the stack of cardboard coupons held together with a rubber band onto my desk. At least 50 Mallow Cup play money cards. I gazed at them as if they might bite.
I guess you figured they would spook you or something.
Maybe.
Well, at least one mystery solved.
He turned to go. Still staring at the cards, I called out,
Hey, Sancho?
He reappeared.
Yeah, boss?
Are you still having those dreams?
The smallest traces of a smile played out on his lips. What dreams?
I smiled back at him.
and he saluted before disappearing. "See you tomorrow, boss." After a moment, I heard the heavy front door shut. My eyes were turned to the manila envelope and the cursive Walter. Picking up the oversized stiletto switchblade I'd carried back from my most recent adventures in Mexico, I slid it across the flap and opened the envelope. There was a photograph, a large, color 8x10 with, of all things, a post-it attached. Carefully sliding it out, I was confronted with the photo of Katie and Lola that I'd used as the screensaver for my now-departed computer. Smiling, I read the post-it. "Walter, sometimes it's best for us old dogs to not learn any more new tricks. Love, Ruby. P.S. Get your own frame." Standing, I patted my leg, and Dog followed as I walked through the office, turning out the lights, finally stopping at Ruby's desk. I wasn't aware of it until I felt the tug at my coat and watched as my hand turned and opened the Absaroka County Sheriff's badge lying there in my palm after I'd evidently unpinned it from my jacket. I read the words and then recommitted the image to my mind. The open book for justice, the mountains for steadfastness, and the star for truth, but all significant of something so much more. And this is how things end. Not so much with a bang, but with a whimper. I gently placed the gleaming hardware on the smooth, oak-grained surface of Ruby's desk. Turning, I started to take a step, but then stopped and stood there looking at the floor, my hand still resting on the surface of the desk. "You pin that star on, and you think it's something you can just take off. But it isn't that way. It attaches itself to you. Unlike the glimmering pinpricks in the freezing winter sky, this star warms you and becomes a welcome weight that doesn't let go even if you wanted to. If its closest kin, over 93 million miles away, were to simply switch off, the average temperature on Earth would plummet to 0 degrees. In a year, it would be 100 below zero. In a million years, 400 degrees below. Better to not risk it." I picked up the star and pinned it back on, immediately feeling warmer. Dog followed me down the steps, where I flipped the last switch off, stepped outside and locked the door behind me. On the drive out of town, under the blinking yellow lights, I mused on the Mallow Cup cards and all the different places that I'd found them. But I couldn't work out how she could have placed the one under the travelogue where the Wolf 777M had been perched. Maybe she hadn't planted all of them after all. Noticing that the gas gauge was nearing empty, I drove under the interstate highway and took a left through the empty opposing lane to pull into the vacant lot of the closed Maverick station. It was getting cold again, so I zipped up my horsehide jacket and flipped up the collar, tugged on my hat, and pulled on my gloves. Standing there, filling the tank, I realized this was the exact spot where I'd confronted Donnie Lott. And I gazed at the motel across the street and then to the I-25 northbound off-ramp. Maybe I'd head south for a few days to entertain my granddaughter and annoy my daughter, the greatest legal mind of our time. Maybe I'd grab Vic and head down to Hatch, New Mexico, where it was bound to be warmer. Or maybe I'd just break into the store and steal a six-pack of Rainier beer and go home. Instead, I held a notion in my head for a moment. The image of a bright red Jeep Wrangler coming off the highway, rolling to a California stop at the sign and then driving toward me, pulling up at the other side of the pump. A window rolling down and me stooping to peer into the back seat where a bundled toddler, my granddaughter, sleeps. A toothsome redhead with startling gray eyes is at the wheel and glances up at me. "Hi, Daddy." But that's not what was there. My eyes refocused on the empty stained surface of a concrete pad on the other side of the pump island, a skiff of snow cast across the hard surface, looking for something, anything, to attach itself to. I could see Dog watching me from inside the truck, and then, on the center console, the envelope with the photograph of Katie and Lola.
Maybe Henry was right. Maybe I was awaiting a vision that I wasn't ready for just yet. I wondered what you had to do to be worthy of such things and thought about a world where I would no longer have a place. A world where people always did the right thing. Studying the envelope, I figured maybe a photograph of a vision was enough for now. I looked back at the mountains and listened to the sound of the ever-present wind and the swaying of the trees as they mourned its passing. But more important, I listened for the cry of 7:77 a.m., if you will. Or Larry, if you won't. All I could hear was the whir of technology as the gas filled the tank. And I sighed, wanting to hear that howl so badly. The End. This is George Guidel. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Land of Wolves by Craig Johnson. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold, including Audible.com, Audiobooks.com, Google Play, Apple iTunes, and in public libraries through RB Digital. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.